Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Chris Messini. Tonight, we'll hear Tom Bacon reading again from the writings of Mark Twain. Tonight, Twain turns literary critic, getting his digs in against another American writer, James Fenimore Cooper.
This Twain work is called Fenimore Cooper's Literary Offenses. It was published in the North American Review in 1897. The first few quotes in the work are apparently those of critics speaking of the work of Fenimore Cooper. Twain takes exception to them. The Pathfinder and the Deerslayer stand at the head of Cooper's novels as artistic creations. There are others of his works which contain parts as perfect as to be found in these and scenes even more thrilling. Not one can be compared with either of them as a finished whole. The defects in both of these tales are comparatively slight. They were pure works of art. That was written by one Professor Lounsbury. The five tales reveal an extraordinary fullness of invention, one of the very greatest characters in fiction, Natty Bumppo. The craft of the woodsman, the tricks of the trapper, all the delicate art of the forest were familiar to Cooper from his youth up. That, a quote from one Professor Brander Matthews. And one Wilkie Collins said, "Cooper is the greatest artist in the domain of romantic fiction yet produced by America." And now Twain takes hold. It seems to me that it was far from right for the professor of English literature in Yale, the professor of English literature in Columbia, and Wilkie Collins, to deliver opinions on Cooper's literature without having read some of it. It would have been much more decorous to keep silent and let persons talk who have read Cooper. Cooper's art has some defects. In one place in Deerslayer, and in the restricted space of two-thirds of a page, Cooper has scored 114 offenses against literary art out of a possible 115. It breaks the record. There are 19 rules governing literary art in the domain of romantic fiction, some say 22. In Deerslayer, Cooper violated 18 of them. These 18 require, 1, that the tale shall accomplish something and arrive somewhere. But the Deerslayer tale accomplishes nothing and arrives in the air. 2, they require that the episodes of a tale shall be necessary parts of the tale and shall help to develop it. But as Deerslayer tale is not a tale and accomplishes nothing and arrives nowhere, the episodes have no rightful place in the work since there was nothing for them to develop. 3, they require that the personages in a tale shall be alive, except in the case of corpses, and that always the reader shall be able to tell the corpses from the others. But this detail has often been overlooked in the Deerslayer tale. 4, they require that the personages in a tale, both dead and alive, shall exhibit a sufficient excuse for being there. But this detail also has been overlooked in the Deerslayer tale. 5, they require that when the personages of a tale deal in conversation, the talk shall sound like human talk, and be talk such as human beings would be likely to talk in the given circumstances, and have a discoverable meaning, also a discoverable purpose, and a show of relevancy, and remain in the neighborhood of the subject at hand, and be interesting to the reader, and help out the tale, and stop when the people cannot think of anything more to say. But this requirement has been ignored from the beginning of the Deerslayer tale to the end of it. 6, they require that when the author describes the character of a personage in his tale, the conduct and conversation of that personage shall justify said description. But this law gets little or no attention in the Deerslayer tale, as Natty Bumppo's case will amply prove. 7, they require that when a personage talks like an illustrated gilt-edged tree-calf hand-tool $7 friendships offering in the beginning of a paragraph, he shall not talk like a minstrel at the end of it. But this rule is flung down and danced upon in the Deerslayer tale. 8, they require that crass stupidities shall not be played upon the reader as, quoting, the craft of the woodsman, the delicate art of the forest, by either the author or the people in the tale, but this rule is persistently violated in the Deerslayer tale. 9, they require that the personages of a tale shall confine themselves to possibilities and let miracles alone, or if they venture a miracle, the author must so plausibly set it forth as to make it look possible and reasonable. But these rules are not respected in the Deerslayer tale. 10, They require that the author shall make the reader feel a deep interest in the personages of his tale and in their fate, and that he shall make the reader love the good people in the tale and hate the bad ones. But the reader in the Deerslayer tale dislikes the good people in it, is indifferent to the others, and wishes they would all get drowned together. 11. They require that the characters in a tale shall be so clearly defined that the reader can tell beforehand what each will do in a given emergency. But in the Deerslayer tale, this rule is vacated. In addition to these large rules, there are some little ones, and they require that the author shall, 12, say what he is proposing to say, not merely come near it, 13, use the right word, not its second cousin, 14, eschew surplusage, 15, not omit necessary details, 16, avoid slovenliness of form, 17, use good grammar, 18, employ a simple and straightforward style. Even these 7 are coldly and persistently violated in the Deerslayer tale. Cooper's gift in the way of invention was not a rich endowment, but such as it was, he liked to work it, he was pleased with the effects, and indeed he did some quite sweet things with it. In his little box of stage properties, he kept 6 or 8 cunning devices, tricks, artifices for his savages and woodsmen to deceive and circumvent each other with. And he was never so happy as when he was working with these innocent things and seeing them go. A favorite one was to make a moccasined person tread in the tracks of the moccasined enemy and thus hide his own trail. Another stage property that he pulled out of his box pretty frequently was his broken twig. He prized his broken twig among all the rest of his effects and worked it the hardest. It is a restful chapter in any book of his when somebody doesn't step on a dry twig and alarm all the reds and whites for 200 yards around. Every time a Cooper person is in peril and absolute silence is worth $4 a minute, he is sure to step on a dry twig. There may be 100 handier things to step on, but that wouldn't satisfy Cooper. Cooper requires him to turn out and find a dry twig, and if he can't do it, go and borrow one. In fact, the Leather Stocking series ought to have been called the Broken Twig series. I'm sorry there's not enough room to put in a few dozen instances of the delicate art of the forest as practiced by Natty Bumppo and some of the other Cooperian experts. Perhaps we may venture 2 or 3 samples. Cooper was a sailor, a naval officer, yet he gravely tells us how a vessel driving toward a lee shore in a gale is steered for a particular spot by her skipper, because he knows of an undertow there which will hold her back against the gale and save her. For just pure woodcraft or sailor craft or whatever it is, isn't that neat? For several years, Cooper was daily in the society of artillery and ought to have noticed that when a cannonball strikes the ground, it either buries itself or skips 100 feet or so, skips again 100 feet or so, and so on till it finally gets tired and rolls. Now, in one place, he loses some females, as he always calls women, on the edge of a wood near a plain at night in a fog on purpose to give Bumppo a chance to show off the delicate art of the forest before the reader. These mislaid people are hunting for a fort. They hear a cannon blast, and a cannonball presently comes rolling into the wood and stops at their feet. To the females, this suggests nothing. The case is very different with the admirable Bumppo. I wish I may never know peace again if he doesn't strike out promptly and follow the track of that cannonball across the plain through the dense fog and find the fort. Isn't it a daisy? If Cooper had any real knowledge of nature's ways of doing things, he had a most delicate art in concealing the fact. We must be a little wary when Brander Matthews tells us that Cooper's books reveal an extraordinary fullness of invention. As a rule, I'm quite willing to accept Brander Matthews' literary judgments and applaud his lucid and graceful phrasing of them, but that particular statement needs to be taken with a few tons of salt. Bless your heart, Cooper hadn't any more invention than a horse, and I don't mean a high-class horse either, I mean a clothes horse. It would be very difficult to find a really clever situation in Cooper's books, and still more difficult to find one of any kind which he has failed to render absurd by his handling of it. If Cooper had been an observer, his inventive faculty would have worked better, not more interestingly, but more rationally, more plausibly. Cooper's proudest creations in the way of situations suffer noticeably from the absence of the observer's protecting eye. Cooper's eye was splendidly inaccurate. Cooper seldom saw anything correctly. He saw nearly all things as through a glass eye, darkly. Of course, a man who cannot see the commonest little everyday matters accurately is working at a disadvantage when he is constructing a situation. In the Deerslayer tales, Cooper has a stream which is 50 feet wide where it flows out of a lake. It presently narrows to 20 as it meanders along for no given reason. And yet, when a stream acts like that, it ought to be required to explain itself. 14 pages later, the width of the brook's outlet from the lake has suddenly shrunk to 30 feet and become the narrowest part of the stream. That shrinkage is not accounted for. The stream has bends in it, a sure indication that it has alluvial banks and cuts them, and yet these bends are only 30 and 50 feet long. If Cooper had been a nice and punctilious observer, he would have noticed that the bends were oftener 900 feet long than short of it. Cooper made the exit of the stream 50 feet wide in the first place for no particular reason. In the second place, he narrowed it to less than 20 to accommodate some Indians. He bends a sapling in the form of an arch over this narrow passage and conceals six Indians in its foliage. They're laying for a settler's scow or ark, which is coming up the stream on its way to the lake. It's being hauled against the stiff current by a rope whose stationary end is anchored in the lake. Its rate of progress cannot be more than a mile an hour. Cooper describes the ark, but pretty obscurely. In the matter of dimensions, it was a little more than a modern canal boat. Let us guess, then, that it was about 140 feet long. It was of greater breadth than common. Let us guess, then, that it was about 16 feet wide. This leviathan had been prowling down bends which were but a third as long as itself and scraping between banks where it had only 2 feet of space to spare on each side. We cannot too much admire this miracle. A low-roofed log dwelling occupies 2/3 of the ark's length, a dwelling 90 feet long and 16 feet wide, let us say. The ark is arriving at the stream's exit now, whose width has been reduced to less than 20 feet to accommodate the Indians, say to 18. There's a foot to spare on each side of the boat. Did the Indians notice that there was going to be a tight squeeze there? Did they notice they could make money by just climbing down out of that arch sapling and stepping aboard when the ark scraped by? No, other Indians would have noticed these things, but Cooper's Indians never notice anything. Cooper thinks they are marvelous creatures for noticing, but he was almost always in error about his Indians. There was seldom a sane one among them. Now, the ark is 140 feet long, the dwelling is 90 feet long. The idea of the Indians is to drop softly and secretly from the arch saplings to the dwelling as the ark creeps along under it at the rate of a mile an hour and butcher the family. It will take the ark a minute and a half to pass under. It will take the 90-foot dwelling a minute to pass under. Now then, what did the six Indians do? It would take you 30 years to guess, and even then you'd have to give it up, I believe. Therefore, I'll tell you what the Indians did. Their chief, a person of quite extraordinary intellect for a Cooper Indian, warily watched the canal boat as it squeezed along under him, and when he had got his calculations fine down to exactly the right shade as he judged, he let go and dropped and missed the house. That is actually what he did. He missed the house and landed in the stern of the scow. It was not much of a fall, yet it knocked him silly. He lay there unconscious. If the house had been 97 feet long, he would have made the trip. The fault was Cooper's, not his. The error lay in the construction of the house. Cooper was no architect. Well, there still remain in the roost 5 Indians. The boat has passed under and is now out of their reach. Let me explain what those 5 did. You would not be able to reason it out for yourself. Number 1 jumped for the boat, but fell in the water astern of it. Number 2 jumped for the boat, fell in the water still further astern of it. Then number 3 jumped for the boat and fell a good way astern of it. Then number 4 jumped for the boat and fell in the water a way astern. Then even number 5 made a jump for the boat, for he was a Cooper Indian. In the matter of intellect, the difference between a Cooper Indian and the Indian that stands in front of the cigar shop is not spacious. The scow episode is really a sublime burst of invention, but it does not thrill because of the inaccuracy of this detail. It throws a sort of air of fictitiousness and general improbability over it. This comes of Cooper's inadequacy as an observer. The reader will find some examples of Cooper's high talent for inaccurate observation in the account of the shooting match in The Pathfinder. Quoting from the book here, "A common wrought nail was driven lightly into the target, its head having been first touched with paint. Now, the color of the paint was not stated, an important omission, but Cooper deals freely in important omissions. No, after all, it was not an important omission, for this nail head is 100 yards from the marksman and could not be seen by them at that distance, no matter what its color might be. How far can the best eye see a common housefly? 100 yards? It's quite impossible. Very well, eyes that cannot see a housefly that is 100 yards away cannot see an ordinary nail head at that distance, for the size of those two objects is the same. It takes a keen eye to see a fly or a nail head at 50 yards, 150 feet. Can the reader do it? The nail was lightly driven, its head painted, and the game called. Then the Cooper miracles began. The bullet of the first marksman chipped an edge of the nail head. The next man's bullet drove the nail a little way into the target and removed all the paint. Haven't the miracles gone far enough now? Not to suit Cooper, for the purpose of this whole scheme is to show off his prodigy, Deerslayer, Hawkeye, Long Rifle, Leather Stocking, Pathfinder, Bumpo, before the ladies. Be all ready to clench it, boys, cried out Pathfinder, stepping into his friend's tracks the instant they were vacant. Never mind the new nail, I can see, though the paint is gone, and what I can see I can hit at 100 yards, though it were only a mosquito's eye. Be ready to clench. The rifle cracked, the bullet sped its way, and the head of the nail was buried in the wood, covered by a piece of the flattened lead. There, you see, is a man who could hunt flies with a rifle and command a ducal salary in a Wild West show today if we had him back with us. The recorded feat is certainly surprising just as it stands, but it is not surprising enough for Cooper. Cooper adds a touch. He has made Pathfinder do this miracle with another man's rifle, and not only that, the Pathfinder did not even have the advantage of loading it himself. He had everything against him, and yet he made that impossible shot, and not only made it, but did it with absolute confidence, saying, "Be ready to clench." Now, a person like that would have undertaken the same feat with a brick bat, and with Cooper to help, he would have achieved it, too. Pathfinder showed off handsomely that day before the ladies. His very first feat was a thing which no Wild West show can touch. He was standing with a group of marksmen, observing, 100 yards from the target, mind. One Jasper raised his rifle and drove the center of the bullseye. Then the quartermaster fired. The target exhibited no result this time. "It's a dead miss," said Major Lundy. Pathfinder waited for an impressive moment or two and then said in that calm, indifferent know-it-all way of his, "No, Major, it's covered Jasper's bullet, as will be seen if anybody will take the trouble to examine the target." Wasn't that remarkable? How could he see that little pellet fly through the air and enter that distant bullet hole? Yet that's what he did, for nothing's impossible to a Cooper person. Did any of these people have any deep-seated doubts about this thing? No, for that would imply sanity. And these were all Cooper people. Quoting again from the book, "The respect for Pathfinder's skill and for his quickness and accuracy of sight was so profound and general that the instant he made this declaration, the spectators began to distrust their own opinions, and a dozen rushed to the target in order to ascertain the fact. There, sure enough, it was found the quartermaster's bullet had gone through the hole made by Jasper's, and that too so accurately as to require a minute examination to be certain of the circumstances, which, however, was soon clearly established by discovering one bullet over the other in the stump against which the target was placed." They made a minute examination. But never mind, how could they know there were two bullets in that hole without digging the latest one out? For neither probe nor eyesight could prove the presence of any more than one bullet. Did they dig? No, as we shall see. It's the Pathfinder's turn now. He steps out before the ladies, takes aim, and fires. But alas, here is a disappointment, an incredible, an unimaginable disappointment, for the target's aspect is unchanged. There is nothing there but that same old bullet hole. "If one dared to hint at such a thing," cried Major Duncan, "I should say the Pathfinder has also missed the target." As nobody yet had missed it, the "also" was not necessary, but never mind about that, for the Pathfinder's going to speak. "No, no, Major," he said confidently, "that would be a risky declaration. I didn't load the piece, and I can't say what was in it, but if it was lead, you'll find the bullet driving down those of the quartermaster and Jasper. Else is not my name Pathfinder. A shout from the target announced the truth of this assertion. Is the miracle now sufficient as it stands? Not for Cooper. The Pathfinder speaks again as he now slowly advances toward the stage occupied by the females. That's not all, boys. That's not all. If you'll find the target touched at all, I'll own to a miss. The quartermaster cut the wood, but you'll find no wood cut by that last messenger. The miracle is now at last complete. He knew, doubtless saw, at the distance of 100 yards that his bullet had passed into the hole without fraying the edges. There were now 3 bullets in that one hole, 3 bullets embedded processionally in the body of the stump back of the target. Everybody knew this, somehow or other, and yet nobody had dug any of them out to make sure. Cooper is not a close observer, but he is interesting. He is certainly always that, no matter what happens. And he is more interesting when he is not noticing what he is about than when he is. This is a considerable merit. The conversations in the Cooper books have a curious sound to our modern ears. To believe that such talk ever really came out of people's mouths would be to believe that there was a time when time was of no value to a person who thought he had something to say, when it was the custom to spread a 2-minute remark out to 10, when a man's mouth was a rolling mill and busied itself all day long in turning 4-foot pigs of thought into 30-foot bars of conversational railroad iron by attenuation, when subjects were faithfully stuck to, but the talk wandered all around and arrived nowhere, when conversations consisted mainly of irrelevancies, with here and there a relevancy with an embarrassed look, as not being able to explain how it got there. Cooper was certainly not a master in the construction of dialogue. Cooper's word sense was singularly dull. When a person has a poor ear for music, he will flat and sharp right along without knowing it. He keeps near the tune, but it is not the tune. When a person has a poor ear for words, the result is a literary flattening and sharpening. You perceive what he is intending to say, but you also perceive that he doesn't say it. This is Cooper. He was not a word musician. His ear was satisfied with the approximate word. I'll furnish some circumstantial evidence in support of this charge. My instances are gathered from a 6 pages of the tale called Deerslayer. He uses verbal for oral, precision for facility, phenomena for marvels, necessary for predetermined, unsophisticated for primitive, preparation for expectancy, rebuked for subdued, explain for determine, mortified for disappointed, meretricious for factitious, materially for considerably, stood for stooped, softened for replaced, rejoined for remarked, brevity for celerity, mental imbecility for imbecility, eyes for sight, counteracting for opposing, funeral obsequies for obsequies. There have been daring people in the work who claim that Cooper could write English, but they're all dead now, all dead but Lounsbury. I don't remember that Lounsbury makes the claim in so many words. Still, he makes it, for he says that Deerslayer is a pure work of art. Pure, in that connection, means faultless, faultless in all details, and language is a detail. If Mr. Lounsbury had only compared Cooper's English with the English which he writes himself, but it's plain he didn't, and so it is likely that he imagines until this day that Cooper's is as clean and compact as his own. Now I feel sure, deep down in my heart, that Cooper wrote about the poorest English that exists in our language, and that the English of Deerslayer is the very worst that even Cooper ever wrote. I may be mistaken, but it does seem to me that Deerslayer is not a work of art in any sense. It does seem to me that it is destitute of every detail that goes into the making of a work of art. In truth, it seems to me that Deerslayer is just simply a literary delirium tremens. A work of art? It has no invention. It has no order, system, sequence, or results. It has no lifelikeness, no thrill, no stir, no seeming of reality. Its characters are confusedly drawn, and by their acts and words they prove they are not the sort of people the author claims they are. Its humor is pathetic. Its pathos is funny. Its conversations are, oh, indescribable. Its love scenes odious. Its English a crime against the language. Counting these out, what's left is art. I think we must all admit to that. Join me again tomorrow on the bookshelf for three more small Twain literary jewels, including a story about his misadventures as an agricultural newspaper editor. For the bookshelf, I'm Tom Bacon.